Well, two tweets on my Twitter feed rise to the top here today. If you've already had enough of memorializing 9/11, just bear with me for a couple of seconds. Chris Gouts of the State Department of Corrections tweeted a photograph of the 9/11 memorial in New York that he says always gets him. And you might not know about this, but I didn't until I saw this. Mr. Gouts went to the Twin Towers Memorial 2 years ago, and on the granite marker there with all the names of the dead, there is one that reads, Katuzi Grandkolas and her unborn child. It was the first I'd ever seen that or heard of that. On a decidedly lighter note, Walt Sorg, after the Lions nearly let defeat slip from the jaws of victory, Walt tweets, "What temperature is it in hell?" which captures the thoughts and emotions of every Lions fan who have seen so many leads slip away over the decades. But we held on. We'll talk about the Lions' win and Tom Izzo's induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame later this hour with current sports, Al Martin. Well, after years of confusion, policies aimed at regulating medical marijuana in Michigan have taken shape. Last week, the state Senate passed a couple of bills that would, among other things, legalize and clarify rules about marijuana dispensaries and medibles, foods containing cannabis that some users prefer to smoking. Michigan's 2008 medical marijuana law did not clarify many aspects of legalized medical pot. That led to a confusing patchwork of regulations and enforcement approaches by municipalities and law enforcement across the state. We welcome two guests today for their thoughts on the Senate bills and what they mean. Willie Roshan runs a marijuana dispensary in Detroit, the Michigan Wellness Group. He's also a member of the Michigan Cannabis Development Association, which is a group of dispensary owners who have worked closely with the legislature crafting these measures. Welcome, Willie Roshan.
Thank you, Mark.
And Jeff Hank is an East Lansing attorney and longtime marijuana activist. He's the leader of MI Legalize, the ballot effort to legalize marijuana in Michigan. Welcome back, Jeff.
Good morning, Mark.
Jeff, you and MI Legalize are in the news for another reason, namely a possible court filing with the U.S. Supreme Court, which you're hoping would validate thousands of signatures to put the legalization question before Michigan voters in November. Briefly, before we dive into these Senate bills and what they mean, can you update us on that effort?
Absolutely. Last week, the Michigan Supreme Court declined to take the case on whether 354,000 signatures that we filed to place this initiative on the November ballot are going to be counted.
So Michigan
Supreme Court, which we are now going to be appealing to the United States Supreme Court. You have 90 days to do that after the highest court of a state rules. And essentially, we're arguing on well-established Supreme Court precedent that once a state grants the initiative right to its people, it can't place undue burdens on that right. And the only reason we're being kept off the ballot is this 1986 Board of Canvassers policy, which required us to validate signatures that were older than 180 days with local clerks. The problem is there's 1,500 local clerks in Michigan. They actually refused to validate our signatures, and the State Bureau of Elections told them they don't have to. So we were left without a way for the state to give us to actually rebut the presumption that these voters are valid. We were able to use the state's own qualified voter file database to show that they are. So our argument is that this policy, which is impossible to comply with, not that we didn't want to comply with it, but that logistically it was impossible, is an undue burden on the initiative right, and it's not a justification to not count the signatures of registered Michigan voters. So that's the argument primarily will be taken to the United States Supreme Court.
But that is the same approach that you've taken with the Court of Appeals and the Michigan Supreme Court. I mean, your suit would not change significantly.
No.
In what you're saying.
No, okay. It's okay. Not. But the lower courts didn't actually address any of those questions, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, let's get to the bills. There's a lot in these bills. Let's unpack what we can. First, let me get your brief responses, if possible, to what appear to be two key parts of these bills. First, the legalization and the regulation of dispensaries. Willie Roshan, what do you think of that?
We think it's great. We think it's great for the medical marijuana patients in the state of Michigan.
And Jeff Hank, what do you think? This is a move in the right direction?
In general, it's a move in the right direction, which, you know, after 8 years of not having any sort of regulatory framework, the details will remain to be seen how it will be played out.
Why do you think it's such a good move, Willie?
From what we understand, you know, from previous court rulings, dispensaries have been deemed illegal and can be turned into a public nuisance, which gave a lot of the patients of the state no access to medical marijuana. now they're going to have access in their local community, if their local community agrees with it.
And the legalization of medibles, Jeff, I'll turn to you.
Well, that's the best part of these bills. That's the one that's least controversial. I mean, you had Michigan courts essentially rule that non-smokable forms of marijuana, particularly for people, you know, like epilepsy patients who use cannabis oils, were illegal. And you had parents being forced to grow marijuana for their children who are having seizures and things like that. Now they're going to have easier access. So that's the silver lining, the best of these bills, is that those things will now be available, hopefully, to Michigan patients.
And Willie Rochon, both of these parts that we've talked about, the legalization of dispensaries and the medibles, these were both things that your association was lobbying for?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And I take it local governments will still play a role here. They would still determine whether a business could open and where. Is that your understanding, Jeff?
It is, and then you would also have to have approval by the state, which will be setting up some advisory boards appointed by the legislature and by the governor to determine who gets those licenses, along with approval of the locals.
Some critics in the legislature who oppose these bills say that they feel they're a prelude to full legalization in the state. Willie Rochon, what do you think of that opposition?
The MCDA was created to advance the medical marijuana laws in the state of Michigan. We had no drive to work on legalization whatsoever. It never actually came up at all. The only time we ever talked about any type of legalization efforts is when we just had side conversations about how MyLegalize was doing.
Hmm. And Jeff Hank, I can imagine how you feel about that criticism. Why don't you just tell us more?
Well, I don't think it's a coincidence that after 8 years of inaction, the day after the Michigan Supreme Court said MyLegalize will not be on the November ballot, that the Senate finally enacted at least medical marijuana regulation. It's not a coincidence. I mean, obviously, had the initiative been on the ballot, it would have conflicted with anything the legislature did. And I think the legislature rightly realized that they have to do something. They cannot just, you know, engage in inaction. So, but, you know, a lot of them also realize that this is likely coming. You're going to have five more states at least this November voting on it, including California. The entire West Coast may have legal marijuana, and it is likely coming to Michigan sooner rather than later. And I think the state legislators don't live in a bubble, and they realize there has to be a framework to do that. And this medical framework really could be expanded to full legalization. I think that's a lot of them do have that in the back of their mind, whether they say that or not.
We are getting responses and information about the recently passed measures in the state Senate that would create a host of regulations and processes and a taxation scheme for medical marijuana here in Michigan. Our guests are Jeff Hank, who you just heard from, the driving force behind MI Legalize, an organization hoping to legalize marijuana in Michigan. Also, Willie Rochon's on the phone. He runs a Detroit dispensary, the Michigan Wellness Group. He's also a member of the Michigan Cannabis Development Association. These bills would reportedly authorize the state to impose a 3% income tax on every provisioning center. Willie Rochon, what do you make of that?
It's actually an excise tax. And that excise tax is actually that whole framework was built to help the local governments not only fund the program, but help your local police departments, help your local fire departments, and anything your local municipality determines that those funds can be used for. There's also money going to the state and the counties.
Well, you've described these measures as business friendly, good for entrepreneurs, good for commerce. Wouldn't taxation of some kind, don't taxes and fees serve as kind of a disincentive for anyone considering opening up one of these businesses?
You know what? I don't believe so. I think that most stores and most businesses will definitely eat that 3%. I think throughout this entire process, you're going to actually see the prices of medical marijuana drop for all the patients.
Jeff Hank, any thoughts about that?
Well, regarding the future pricing, that's hard to say, but it's likely. It is odd that medical marijuana would be the only medical or medicine taxed in the state of Michigan. Other medicines are exempt. So it's a little departure from your standard norm. I kind of laugh politically that Republicans who signed a no-tax pledge just voted to tax medical marijuana. But like Willie said, there does have to be a way to fund these programs. So we'll see how the future plays out with that.
Willie, would you expect, as a result of these measures, assuming they're signed into law, would you expect more competition over the long haul, or would you expect less competition?
Absolutely. We expect a lot of competition.
Absolutely what? More or less?
But more competition. This legislation sparks more competition throughout the state, which will eventually help prices drop.
I know that an idea that's kicked around the Lansing City Council and the city attorney's office involves pretty significant fees to register a marijuana business. Jeff, do you know if these Senate bills, would these Senate bills authorize local governments to charge fees and taxes on top of any state fees
they don't have
to pay?
They don't authorize taxes, but they do authorize fees. I believe the current version allows a municipality to charge up to $5,000 for a license. So, I mean, the bills in general do create a pretty extensive regulatory framework, which a lot of people, I might depart from Willie here, I think you're going to see a lot of business people now feel safe to get into this commercial aspect because it's more legally safe to do so. But there's a lot of barriers to entry here.
Yeah.
So.
Dispensaries and growers and processors and transporters would, as I understand it, have to get a state license to operate and renew that annually. Willie Rochon, any problem with that, or is that just the price of doing business?
That's just the price of doing business throughout the new legislation.
Willie Rochon, does your business pay what taxes does your business pay now?
My family owns a business. I don't run the business.
The Detroit Free Press reported late last week on a possible effort by law enforcement to get Governor Snyder to veto these bills because they would allow, and I'm quoting a lot of this, one-time felons to obtain dispensary licenses 10 years after their conviction or incarceration. Oakland County Sheriff Mike Bouchard here. Why would we allow that in a highly regulated business that has real dangers? Does he have a point, Jeff?
No, I don't think so. Bouchard's always been opposed to these bills. You know, right now, even without regulation, we haven't really seen a problem with dispensaries. I mean, you can probably point to, you know, an incident here or there, but no more different than any other businesses in terms of safety or crime or whatever. So I'm also kind of the person that believes, well, like, once someone does their time, you know, for their crime, they should get a fresh start. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, unless there's an actual reason to keep someone out of the business that can be articulated, I think it's a little bit of the posturing that you've seen from law enforcement all along related to these bills.
Mark, also, law enforcement reps were contacted throughout this entire process and have had access to this entire process. So they've known what's been going on the entire time.
Do you think Mike Bouchard and others who feel the same way are in the minority in the law enforcement community, Willie? Is that what you're saying?
I believe in 2008, 63% of the voters in this state enacted a medical marijuana law. And it seems their constituents want this.
But is Bouchard in the minority amongst law enforcement?
You know, I can't comment on that. I'm not in law enforcement.
Okay.
So I wouldn't know. I haven't spoke to that many law enforcement officers about the issues. I have talked to a few of them. And the few that I've spoken with will be glad to see it be in a commercial area and be an industrial area as opposed to just rampant throughout the houses. A lot of the things have been small fires and things like that in your neighborhoods. If they don't want that just because it's a safety risk.
Jeff Hank, what would you change about these bills? Do they overlook anything that's important to you, short of the full legalization of marijuana?
Primarily, it's just over-regulation. I mean, they really haven't articulated a need for all this. I mean, a secure transporter, that marijuana would need to be transported by two people. The law actually says there has to be two people in a vehicle. So when a grower transports marijuana to a dispensary, some people say this is going to have to be in an armored truck. I don't know if that's exactly true or not, but it does say that two people have to transport it. Mm. That's really not necessary. You don't see pharmaceutical companies doing that. The only people see doing that are Brinks trucks carrying large amounts of cash and things like that. And I don't think that patient medicine should be taxed either. There's a lot of other nitpicky things we could get into, but those are sort of the big picture things. And just this idea that it's such a heavy regulatory model. I think at least at the start, you're going to see less patient access because people who are not, do not have licenses to operate are going to have to shut down. Mm-hmm. So until the state actually rolls out a licensing program, it may actually harm the patients. But again, that remains to be seen how that plays out a year from now or whatever.
Willie, we've got 30 seconds. If you could change one thing about these bills, what would you change?
I wouldn't have any changes to the bills right now. In order to see how this is all going to work, we have to actually see it in action. So we don't know what the pros and cons actually are today.
We wait to see what the House will do. These measures, it's my understanding, have already passed the House, but just formally they've got to go back and re-clear the House before they go to the governor. We want to thank our guests, Willie Rochon, who runs a Detroit dispensary, the Michigan Wellness Group. He's also a member of the Michigan Cannabis Development Association. Attorney Jeff Hank is with MI Legalize, an organization hoping to legalize marijuana in Michigan. Willie, Jeff, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks.
Outcasting is a Pacifica radio project producing programs for LGBTQ youth.
LGBTQ issues are very rarely covered in the mainstream media.
Current State Scott Paul talks with founder Mark Sofus, an MSU grad, and with a student working on getting outcasting established here on the MSU campus. That's on the way here on Current State. The 10-Pound Fiddle Concert and Dance Series just announced the lineup for its 2016-2017 season. Their 42nd season kicks off this Friday. With us here in the studio to talk about the new season is the musician who books all the shows for 10-Pound Fiddle, Sally Potter. Welcome back, Sally.
Hey, welcome. Thank
you.
You've
been on the show several times before, and you won't be performing today.
No.
I don't see any stringed instruments. That you're hauling around here. You got three groups of attractions going on. You've got concerts, dances, and what are called Fiddle Scout gatherings. For our listeners who don't know what those are, what are they?
Well, start with the Fiddle Scouts because they're only 4 years old. Tomiko and MC Rothhorn stepped up to the plate and organized a gathering of little people, officially 3 to 13-year-olds, but we have a lot of 4, 5, 6, 7-year-olds. And it's where folks, it's kind of a drop-in gathering at the MSU Community Music School hosts it. And the Fiddle books musicians that actually play music with kids. So we'll have a drummer there in October, and there'll be 60 kids playing drums all at the same time.
Wow.
And from Lori, she's from Ann Arbor. She's phenomenal. We're starting out this Saturday. And with a guy who's doing interactive songs, harmonicas come or hammer dulcimer or mountain dulcimers. Every month there's a different emphasis on different kind of music or a different kind of instrument. There are a couple of singing gatherings. There's a family dance in February. So every month it's an event where kids and their parents can just drop in and play with music. 10 o'clock the second Saturday of the month.
Let's move on to the concerts, which begin this Friday evening. There are 27 altogether scheduled throughout the rest of the year and into 2017. Who's opening the season Friday?
Andy Irvine is an incredibly famous Irish singer of Irish songs, classic Irish songs. He's been the front man for Patrick Street and Planxty and a lot of Irish bands through the years. His agent called and said, hey, he's just been booked to headline this coming weekend's Muskegon Irish Fest. What are you doing on Friday night? And I said, well, I think we're opening with Andy Irvine.
we got a little sample of Andy Irvine. This is Will You Come to the Bower?
Will you come to the Bower? O'er the free boundless ocean, where the stupendous waves roll in thunder and motion, where the mermaid is seen and the fierce tempest gather.
On to Susan Werner, who is coming the following Friday. What's Susan all about?
Susan grew up in Iowa, and she was a folk singer, and she got pretty famous. And then she said, you know, I want to go to the Berklee School of Music and learn jazz. So she stopped.
Wow.
And then
there's
she
a transition.
Hung out in Boston and learned jazz and the piano and piano chords. And that just brings more variety to her shows. She, you know, you have a piano and she brings a guitar, and she is a performer's performer, and she's funny, and she writes stunning songs. She'll do an album of gospel songs. Written in modern form with modern topics like civil rights and other rights, everybody's rights. And then she'll do an original CD of classic kind of old-time swing tunes. Anyway, her musical repertoire is phenomenal. She has incredible set lists, and she has a great following in this area. She lives in Chicago now, and she'll just drive up and do us on Friday night and the Ark on Saturday night.
I'm curious to see if Susan Werner has any jazz-inflected qualities here to what we're about to hear. Let's listen to Susan Werner. This is called Help Somebody.
I got plenty and then some. What do I do? Plenty and then some. What do I do? I got plenty and then some. What do I do now? I go out and help somebody. Get plenty and then some too.
I got a roof. That's a slightly different sound than you might expect.
Well,
from
that was the beginning of a
fiddle.
Song, and then that song just starts rolling in the piano, and the drum comes in even more. She just, you never know what her shows are going to be, but they're always fabulous.
Exciting. May Erlewine will be coming in February. Describe May's music.
Well, May and Seth have been mainstays in the Earthwork Music Co-op for a good 10 years. They're starting to do separate shows more, and May's, Seth does a lot of more rock and roll these days. May's voice is what draws everybody to May's shows, and she also writes some really nice songs. One is called Shine On, and it's in the recent Rise Again songbook. She's going up in the ranks nationally of a marvelous singer of really good songs.
Let's listen to May Erlewine. This is Shine On.
Stop running away from it. Next time you see me, I will be singing a new song. I am learning shine.
May Erlewine there. It's called Shine On. Shine. Lots of folk and acoustic music enthusiasts know about Kitty Donahoe, but just remind the uninitiated about Kitty.
Kitty lived here for years and put her kids through school, and she also booked a 10-pound fiddle about 25 years ago when her kids were little. She moved to Ann Arbor. She wrote a song about 9/11 that's pretty famous. The Air Force just put a video to it. And she's releasing a new CD called The Irishman's Daughter, and that'll be a CD release party on October 7th.
That the CD release party is the performance.
Is the performance.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It's not just a party. It's like she does the show, but we're all going to buy a CD because it'll be available.
Here's Kitty Donahoe singing Kid with a Gun.
Pretty girls laugh when he passes by. His hair's kind of weird, he's a tad too short. He'll never be a star on the basketball court. He's an okay student, he comes from good seed. He's never been in trouble, what more do you need? He's somebody's baby, somebody's son. He's a kid with a problem, he's a kid with a gun.
Katie Donahoe there. It's A Kid with a Gun. We kind of skipped by the dance opportunities here. What kinds of dances?
Well, they're contra dances. And about 30 years ago, Bob Stein and Laura Stein moved to town. And Bob called it dances, and Laura made a band. And since then, the contra dance community has exploded all over Michigan. And the Midwest has a healthy community. There's even a bigger community on the East Coast. They're not English country dances that you find in Pride and Prejudice BBC movies, but they're not the square dances where everybody gets dolled up and in short skirts and the men's have
bolo ties.
It's sort of in the middle. They have walkthroughs to a live band and a caller, and the caller will tell you to go left or right and what to do. It's really fun, and they do them at the Central United Methodist Church with a really big wood floor. The Tempon Fiddle does dances on the first Saturday. Looking Glass Music and Arts does the dances on the third Saturday, and there's a Looking Glass's Music and Arts huge festival is coming up on September 30th, October 1 and 2. And both groups kind of get together and put that on.
And where do, remind our listeners, where all these events take place?
Well, that's the thing. The Tempon Fiddles run out of a post office box. So we rent venues. Most of the Tempon Fiddle concerts are at the Community Music School on South Hagedorn. We will also have two concerts at the Allen Marketplace, complete with a cash bar. We'll also have a huge midwinter singing and folk festival on Martin Luther King weekend, and we hold that at the Hanna Center.
And there's you've got a revamped website, which is always a load of work here. Remind our listeners of the web address.
Well, Kate Peterson has made it look phenomenal. It's at 10poundfiddle, TenPoundFiddle.org.
I've been speaking with Sally Potter of the 10-Pound Fiddle Concert and Dance Series. Their upcoming season is their 42nd. It kicks off Friday night with a concert at Allen Marketplace. Thank you, Sally.
Thanks a lot.
Well, the Detroit Lions started their NFL season with a win in the win column as they beat the Colts in a game that went to the wire. Also, Al Martin joins us to recap Tom Izzo's induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame over the weekend. Current Sports Al Martin on the way on Current State. Current State, three times every weekday on WKAR 9 and 6 on 90.5 FM. Catch us on AM at noon, AM 870 WKAR, and everything we do ends up at WKAR.org, our website, a New York-based radio program and podcast working with LGBTQ youth, is starting its first operation away from the Big Apple. It's called Outcasting, and there's a meeting later this week to launch the project at Michigan State. Current State Scott Pohl talked with the founder of Outcasting. And who is that, Scott?
Well, his name is Mark Sofas. He's a radio veteran and an MSU grad. He started Outcasting as a place for the stories of LGBTQ youth to be told and to be heard. When we talked last week, we were joined by an MSU student named Cale Black, who's helping bring Outcasting to East Lansing. Sofas spoke with me about Media for the Public Good, the nonprofit he started that led to Outcasting.
Media for the Public Good is actually a successor organization to Hudson Valley Community Radio, which was the owner of WDFH, a nonprofit public radio station I used to run in Westchester County, New York. WDFH ultimately went off the air, and Outcasting survived, and so we needed to change the name to Media for the Public Good. So it is a 501c3 nonprofit.
So how long have you been doing Outcasting?
Outcasting began in, it was right around the beginning of 2011 when I started trying to get youth from high schools in the area. And we actually put together the first group of people in June of 2011. And over the summer, I started to teach them some basics about audio production and interviewing and journalism and that sort of thing. And the program debuted in October of 2011.
And the program, as I understand it, can be heard on several dozen radio stations around the country, and it's also a podcast. Is all of that correct?
Yes, it's heard on, we don't have an exact count, but somewhere around 45 to 50 Pacifica public radio radio stations around the country, and it's, of course, available through iTunes and on our website, which is outcastingmedia.org.
So tell me about the focus of the show and maybe how you started the show, whether that focus has shifted over the last few years. What is outcasting all about?
Basically, the problem that we're trying to address is that LGBTQ issues are very rarely covered in the mainstream media, and LGBTQ youth issues are pretty much limited to when a child takes his or her own life, and it's really very superficial, and we wanted to give dimension to those lives and allow youth stories to be told. And over the years, the focus has shifted a little bit more toward coverage of LGBT issues, sometimes youth issues and sometimes LGBT issues in general, from a youth perspective.
How frequently is there a new show?
Right now, we're producing, on average, about 6 to 8 new programs a year. One of the purposes of the MSU Bureau and establishing other bureaus is to increase to monthly production, and the long-term goal is weekly.
Am I understanding correctly that MSU's is your first bureau outside your immediate geographic area there in New York?
Yes, it is. And it actually came as a result of my husband and I being on campus a couple of years ago and talking with Dee Hurlburt, who is the director of the MSU LGBT Resource Center. And she was sort of intrigued with the idea of an MSU bureau. I actually run the two bureaus here in New York, our home studio in Westchester County and the New York City Bureau. And so the MSU Bureau is the first that's not under my direct control, and it's really exciting.
Cale Black, I want to bring you in here now. How did you hear about outcasting? What appeals to you about taking part in the project?
So actually, I heard of it first from, it was in an email. I think it was from the LGBTQ Resource Center here at MSU. And I was just kind of browsing and trying to figure out what kind of queer student groups that I wanted to be a part of. And it sounded interesting, and I went to the first meeting and ended up being a part of it.
You were an incoming freshman at the time then?
Yeah, correct. Okay. Sophomore this year.
All right. And so in that year, has that amounted to you doing anything with relation to the project so far?
We're kind of focusing on doing our first long-form show. We're also primarily working on our outcasting off-air right now, which is just online-only, shorter programs.
Am I correct that you'll be supplying material to Mark and he'll be incorporating that into the national program?
Yeah, it's all goes to the same place as well on our website, mediaformfpg.org. I think generally, and Mark could probably clarify as well, we just pretty much do our own productions, trying to kind of match the way the show has gone before a little bit, but also having our own spin and take on things.
Mark, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that's good. You know, it can start with pieces that the MSU Outcasters send to us, or it can be complete programs. Either way is fine.
We're talking about Outcasting. It's a radio and podcasting program of a nonprofit called Media for the Public Good, with a focus on LGBTQ youth, with founder Mark Sofas. He's an MSU grad, and we also have with us MSU student Cale Black, who's involved with bringing Outcasting to Michigan State University. Outcasting claims to have a place for those who are closeted. I'd like to have you take a moment to explain how that might work, since it's a public forum on a podcast and a radio program. How would that work?
Well, we never wanted people who were closeted to feel that they couldn't participate. And people have different degrees of outness. We had one student, a high school student, who was totally closeted. He was out only to his mother when he first joined the program. If people are concerned about not being out publicly, they can participate behind the scenes. If they want to write material, other people can read it. You know, there are a lot of ways that we can protect their identity. If they want to be open, that's fine too. And the program is also open to straight allies. And straight allies have been an important part of the show ever since it began.
I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to ask you about a role for straight allies, maybe not just as producers of content, but also as potential consumers of the program.
Yeah, well, I think that most of the people who listen to the program are probably not LGBTQ themselves. It is heard by a general public radio audience on, as I said, about 45 to 50 public radio stations around the country. And, you know, a lot of people, if they don't have a reason to seek out LGBTQ content, really may not know very much. And outcasting can provide a way to sort of educate people about some of the issues our community faces.
KL, I assume you've listened to the show.
Yes, I have.
Do you have favorite stories or episodes that you might give us as an example of the content people might hear on the program?
I think one that's particularly interesting, I don't remember the exact episode number, but it was on asexuality, and they had a member of Outcasting go through his story, how he figured out who he was and everything like that. I thought that was interesting because I think an interesting thing about Outcasting is it's an interesting perspective, you know, queer youth. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, queer students, LGBTQ students, LGBTQ people, that offers a wide range of perspectives and people. And I think the story about a kid who is asexual was very interesting.
Here at MSU, is this going to be strictly a student-run organization, or will faculty and maybe other sorts of advisors be involved here at Michigan State?
Yes, there are actually four at the moment. One is on sabbatical. The three others are in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences.
You brought up having a high schooler involved in the project earlier, Mark, and I wanted to ask you again, not just as participants, but as potential audience for the program. It's not just college level and above that you're hoping to get involved in the Outcasting project, right?
Well, in terms of involvement, I mean, we certainly can always use more adult volunteers, but it really is a youth-based program. My voice is actually never even heard on the program. I do the funding announcements for the online version, but during the show itself, I'm never heard. And that's by design. We want the show to be really about youth and by youth.
Kale, I wanted to ask you a question about the perspective of an MSU student. Aside from the content of the program, if you feel like there's a professional development component to being involved in terms of radio production or learning how to conduct interviews, do you feel like once things really get rolling here in East Lansing that there will be professional development for students who take part?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm not studying like in radio or anything like that, or even really any media right now. But I think one of the things that drew me to it was that I took debate in high school. So I had some speaking experience, and I thought it was really cool to be part of like making a radio show. And I mean, for anyone who doesn't really know what goes into making radio or really any sort of media outlet, is that there's a whole lot that goes into it. I mean, there's plenty of writing, plenty of technical stuff. And I think that it's really useful that whether or not you're planning on going into radio or production, you learn useful skills either way.
Are there other outlets for these kinds of stories in radio, television, online, where people can do this kind of work and get paid for it someday?
Not that I'm aware of. As far as I know, we're the only LGBTQ youth program in public radio in the United States, which is really unfortunate, but I think that's the case. But I do think, you know, getting back to what you were talking about professional development, you know, we develop research skills in our students, and that is highly transferable. Speaking and writing for broadcast, interviewing techniques, digital audio production, promotion using social media and other channels. And I think a lot of those skills can be worked into a lot of different kinds of things that people can do after they leave the program.
I wanted to ask about this informational meeting on Wednesday, what people will find when they get there, and also maybe how students who might find the project interesting but can't make it that night might be able to get more information. Can you shed some light on that for us, Kale?
On mfpg.org, they have, actually right now, the top post on there is the info for that meeting. If you contact pretty much anyone that's a part of Outcasting, we'll be able to get you to where you need to go. We also have an online presence as well with our Facebook page. And I think even just messaging that we'll be able to provide you with information you need. And we're always going to have, of course, more meetings throughout the year. So whenever you're available, we'll always be able to take anyone in.
Outcasting is a radio program and podcast for LGBTQ youth, and it's coming to East Lansing. There's a meeting for interested students, including straight allies, on Wednesday at 5 p.m. in the MSU Main Library's MAP Library. That's room 308F of the Main Library. We've been talking about outcasting with the founder of the nonprofit creating the program, Media for the Public Good, Mark Sofas, and an MSU student, Cale Black, who's working on outcasting here at Michigan State. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
I'm wondering if you know that there is a Bo Schembechler store that has opened in Ann Arbor. The legendary U of M coach, of course, Glenn Bo Schembechler. There's a retail store that's opened recently on Main Street that sells all manner of Bophilia. I mean, the caps, the images, the wall plaques, the everything. And apparently these young guys, according to Frank Witzel in one of the editions, weekend editions of the Free Press, they started out online, but now they're actually a bricks and mortar store. So prepare for that on your next stroll, your next drive down Main Street in Ann Arbor. Speaking of sports, it looked like it was going to be a repeat of last year's season opener for the Detroit Lions yesterday. The Lions coughed up an 18-point first half lead against the Indianapolis Colts, just as they did last season in a loss to the San Diego Chargers. However, the Lions were able to keep it together. They mustered some last-minute heroics, stunning the Colts at Lucas Oil to win 39-35. It marked only the second time the Lions have won in Indy. We can also talk about the induction of MSU head basketball coach Tom Izzo into the Basketball Hall of Fame. We do that with our very own Al Martin, host of Current Sports on WKAR.
Mark, what's up?
Good
How
to
you doing,
see
my
you.
Man?
Lots to talk about here. What should be the story here? The fact that it's not that we blew a lead. We've done that for a long time. I would imagine the story is that we came up big when we needed to late in the game.
Well, I think it depends on what kind of lens you look at this game from, Mark. I think it's a little bit of both, if you ask me, because, you know, when you look at how this game went, it has to alarm you that, again, this is yet another season opener, as you mentioned, that the Lions did blow an 18-point first-half lead. But at the same time, it wasn't a repeat song of what we saw last year. This is a team that came up when they needed it most. When Matthew Prater, when he missed that extra point and it opened the door for Andrew Luck to drive down the field and score a touchdown. Actually, before that drive even occurred, Mark, I said to myself, we've seen this song before. Matthew Prater opened the door for the Colts to win this game in thrilling fashion and to really invokes yet another game of heartbreak for Detroit Lions right. fans everywhere.
And of all things, a missed extra point.
A missed extra point.
How often does that happen anymore?
Exactly. I mean, that's supposed to be a gimme, right?
Sure.
But then you have Matthew Stafford. He gets the ball back with under a minute left to play. And he showed so much poise, so much confidence, so much leadership in that moment.
Agreed.
I mean, he has three straight completions, Mark. And what I love how the camera panned to Matthew Stafford after he threw that last completion to Marvin Jones Jr. Marvin doesn't get out of bounds, so the Lions have to burn a timeout to stop the clock. And the camera goes to Matthew Stafford, and you can see him completely chewing out Marvin Jones Jr. Get out,
yeah.
get out, you know?
Yeah.
I love that. And that's the leadership that we expect from a starting quarterback like Matthew Stafford in the NFL. He was absolutely fantastic, though. 31 of 39, 340 yards, 3 touchdowns, no turnovers. And how about the rest of the offense as well, especially that backfield? I thought Theo Riddick played a great game, Amir Abdullah, Dwayne Washington. This is a team with a lot of talent offensively, and an offense that I think can really do some special things down the line. But, Mark, that defense has got to get better.
I can't help but think of the Quinn effect, whether the new general manager is having something to do with what we saw yesterday.
Exactly. And you know another name, Bob Quinn, of course. And another name, of course, is Jim Bob Cooter. I love that name, by the way, Jim Bob Cooter.
Sure.
But, I mean, the new offensive coordinator for the Lions, he has brought about a different feel and a different style of play that this offense hasn't seen in quite some time, Mark.
How odd was it not to see Calvin Johnson on the offense yesterday?
Very odd. I mean, this is a guy, Calvin Megatron Johnson, who, in my opinion, goes down as the second greatest wide receiver in NFL history, only second to, of course, in my opinion, the great Jerry Rice. Anytime you have a talent of that magnitude now absent from your offensive scheme, it's going to be an adjustment period. We move into a new era without Calvin now, and it's so odd because we've seen for years the connections, the miraculous connections from Stafford to Calvin Johnson, and now he's no longer there, and now you have to expect guys like Golden Tate and Anquan Boldin now to step into new roles and to really be efficient game in and game out. So it was very odd, but at the same time, I thought Matthew Stafford did a great job at showing the critics out there that Matthew Stafford is not just a good quarterback when Calvin Johnson is out on the football field. He spread the football out across the field. He had eight different targets throughout that game, Mark, and I thought that was very impressive. And he proved to a lot of people that, hey, Megatron may be gone, but that doesn't, you know, roll this offense all the time.
We've just got – I mean, we don't have much to look back on so far in 2016. I mean, the Lions share of the season is still in front of us here. We got a preseason, and we've got one regular season game. Where's your head at on the rest of the season? What should we expect from this team?
Well, I think we'll realistically find out, Mark, in week three, if you ask me, when the Lions, for the first time of the season – get to play a legitimate Super Bowl contending team in the Green Bay Packers. I think in week two, you know, great week one win. Don't get me wrong. This is a big win on the road, as you mentioned. Only the second time this Lions team has won out in Indy. Huge. Week two, they play the Tennessee Titans, a team that fell to the Minnesota Vikings after, you know, really handing the Minnesota Vikings a good old-fashioned butt-whooping in that first half. I mean, Adrian Peterson couldn't do anything. Then all of a sudden, the Titans do what they do. They let Minnesota back in the game, and they end up losing that game. Very talented team, though, for Tennessee. They got Marcus Mariota, former quarterback at Oregon, and also DeMarco Murray, who's a part of his third NFL team now in the last 3 years. He was the best running back in the league when he was with the Dallas Cowboys 3 years ago. A lot of offensive power, and at the same time, I do think the Tennessee Titans defense is good, but not great. I think the Lions start the year, knock on wood, 2-0, Mark. Week three, though, is going to be a very interesting test against Aaron Rodgers and company on the road.
Let's shift gears to basketball here because it was a weekend for Tom Izzo here. Tom was inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, Springfield, Massachusetts, over the weekend. What does this mean to you? What does it mean to the legacy of Coach Izzo?
It just solidifies what we've already known, Mark, for quite some time, that Tom Izzo is a Hall of Fame guy. He's a Hall of Fame coach, and he has been for quite some time now. I mean, this is a man, despite, you know, the accomplishments alone put him in. You know, the national championship, the seven Final Fours, the constant Big Ten tournament titles, the constant Big Ten regular season titles, and all of the talent that he's sent to the NBA that have flourished at that level, sure, that alone puts him in. But I think seeing him up there at that podium, reflecting on his own career and really talking about the moments that got him there and the people that got him there, it just solidifies what we already knew about Tom Izzo. And, you know, what I love about Tom is that he's such a great guy. You know, for those that know him away from the basketball court, he's such a nice guy, but he is one of the most – he is probably the fiercest competitor that I've ever seen in person. I mean, we've seen the rants on the sidelines. We've seen him chew out a player, but he does it with tough love because at the end of the day, he loves every single player that comes through his program. So it was fun to watch what took place out in Springfield this past weekend.
Is there a moment from his speech that stands out for you?
Just for me, Mark, when he made the statement that other than the birth of my children, this is the greatest accomplishment in my life, I that really stood out to me because Tom is a guy, as we all know, who is never satisfied. He's always looking for that next challenge. And I thought for the first time in quite some time, Tom was able to really reflect on what he's done throughout his basketball coaching career and really enjoy it. You know, I've always seen Tom get worked up into a lather as to, okay, we got to win the next game. I got to win another national championship. I've got to go on the recruiting trail. But for him just to sit back and enjoy the moment of his career, that was something that I hadn't quite seen. So that was probably my favorite moment, Mark.
Al Martin, host of WKAR's Current Sports Radio and TV. More on these topics, more on the MSU-Notre Dame game this weekend, I'm sure, coming up at 1 o'clock this afternoon on AM 870 WKAR. Of course, Michigan against Central Florida as well. 2-0 now, two games into the season. Al, thank you.
Hey, anytime, Mark. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, there's been a lot of talk lately about the proposed bus rapid transit system that could one day link downtown Lansing and Meridian Township. But does the whole greater Lansing area need a larger cross-country transportation network, cross-county transportation network? The Tri-County Regional Planning Commission will conduct a comprehensive study of mid-Michigan's transit needs. We'll talk with the commission's executive director, Susan Pigg. Also, the great pianist Yefim Bronfman is making appearances this weekend in Michigan and showing two sides of his virtuosity, first with the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra performing Tchaikovsky on Friday, then on Sunday, a solo piano performance at the Wharton Center. We'll ask him about maneuvering that split personality when it comes to playing 88 keys. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. We're on Facebook too, Current State from WKAR. Have a great day. We'll see you Tuesday. This is Current State on WKAR.